Welcome to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm Graham Richmond, and today we are truly fortunate to have a special guest on the show. Her name is Cassandra Ray Pittman, and she is the host of an incredibly popular podcast that's called Power Done Differently. And it features candid conversations between Cassandra and some amazing female leaders. FYI, by candid, I really mean candid and honest, and sometimes even like R-rated, so just putting that out there. Cassandra is also a Columbia MBA and a former marketing and admissions officer over at LBS and INSEAD. She has a reputation for championing women in business and for telling it like it is, and that reputation, I feel like, has only been reinforced by this new podcast, Power Done Differently. Her bio states that she's a California-born longtime Londoner who loves Mexican food, dinner parties, and deep chats with good friends. So welcome, Cassandra, to the show.
Thanks for having me, Graham. It's so nice to chat with you again. It's been far too long.
Yeah, agreed. And full disclosure here, Cassandra and I go a ways back. We first met, I want to say maybe even like 15 years ago, when you were working at INSEAD and Clear Admit was sort of just getting rolling. And I still remember that I just found your kind of business savvy approach to be really refreshing, because sometimes when you're working with universities, people are not so quick to sort of seize on new platforms or technologies. And so I still remember that just being like, wow, here's someone at INSEAD who's like open to what Clear Admit's doing and to kind of working with us. So that was really cool. Still appreciate that to this day.
Well, that's really nice. I know what you mean, though. I don't think that education has a reputation for being the most sort of agile and innovative industry, but it's gonna have to get both a lot more agile and a lot more innovative because change has arrived.
Yes.
So I think the business schools and universities that survive will be the ones that are out in front.
Absolutely. Do you have the skills needed to succeed in your MBA? Harvard Business School Online's Core Business Essentials program is an MBA prep course that offers immersive, real-world learning, 100% online. Prepare for the classroom with the program Harvard Business School offers to incoming students. Visit hbsonline.co today. So before we get into it, I did want to ask you like some background stuff. So I know you're from California originally, and yet, you know, with the exception of one impromptu Mexican dinner party that I attended with you in San Fran like several years ago, I've mostly run into you in Paris and London. So tell me the story about how you ended up in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I think just a lot of youthful arrogance is basically how I ended up in Europe. So I went to university for a year in the States, a school called Rollins College in Florida. And while I was there, I got involved in politics and I took some time off and worked for the Democratic Party. And, you know, exactly where you should not be if you are an idealistic 18-year-old is in fundraising for politics, like in politics. It was like the worst match, right? And I don't know, I can't really remember the circumstances, but I had put in an application to study at to the American University in London. And I thought, oh, maybe I would go and take some classes there for a year. But, you know, that had kind of just been the back of my mind. And in the meantime, I took this job for the Democratic Party, arrived there and was like, oh, my God, this is not for me. And so 2 weeks before classes started in London, I just said, am I allowed to swear on this podcast, Graham? I don't know the rules. I just said, screw it. I guess I can say.
You know, it's funny. I was going to mention that I noticed that your podcast tends to be kind of R-rated. And I will say, like ours, we typically try to keep it clean. But,
okay,
but you know,
I'll keep
we
it
do
clean
what you
for
want.
You. I'll keep it clean for you. So, yeah, I signed like that can't be right. Maybe $150,000 in loan paperwork. I don't know. A lot of loans, a lot of student loans. And bought a one-way ticket to London. I had like $200 or $250 in traveler's checks. I arrived to the UK. I remember still being grilled by the immigration officer saying, how do you intend to support yourself? Show me a credit card, show me a bank statement. And I was like, I have these traveler's checks. And I just arrived in London and then fell in love with the city and didn't want to leave. And that, you know, embarked me on a whole international path.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I have to say, I love London too. And it's something that, you know, the coronavirus has had all kinds of impact. One of which is like, I have not moved really from Paris much, except for a quick summer vacation within Europe. But I one of the things I miss most is I used to go to London, you know, several times a year for work, and I really miss it. It's such a vibrant city, and I'm sure I can just imagine arriving there as a young person. And but so how, you know, like how did that lead to you working at London Business School? Because that was one of your first things, right?
You
started pretty early there.
Yeah. So I actually, after my undergrad, I did an undergrad in international relations, and I then did a postgrad in Brussels in European integration and development. And I was still, you know, at this point, still very political, quite on the left of things, and thought I wanted to, you know, work in pressure group politics or maybe join the European Commission. And it hadn't occurred to me at 20, 21 years old that that I needed to be European to work for the European Commission. And so that somehow that dawned on me sort of halfway through my master's degree. And so I came back to London and I was looking for roles in the nonprofit sector. And I stumbled upon this role at London Business School. And at this stage, I mean, I had no interest in business. Or at least I didn't think I had an interest in business. I look back now and I was like running several different things, but I didn't think I had an interest in business, but it was more the role itself. And, you know, it was in education. So I was feeling quite good about that. And actually, I mean, I need to go back to the people who hired me at London Business School at some stage and just thank them for this incredible path they put me on, because my time there is what really opened my eyes to just the diversity of things you can do with an MBA and how much impact, without sounding too cheesy, how much impact you can have on things you really care about when you are more active in business. And so that's what drew me. That was really just, you know, part timing, part luck. And then, of course, I was able to get hired at INSEAD, and that was incredible because I worked with them in Singapore, France, and New York. So I had this incredible kind of cross-continental experience with them, and then ended up drinking my own Kool-Aid and doing the MBA at Columbia.
Yeah, so I want to pause there for a second, and I would love to know, like, what's the difference between admissions and marketing over at like London Business School versus then INSEAD, where, again, I think you were with INSEAD maybe longer, and I remember you kind of were part of their opening an office in the United States and New York and stuff. But like, how would you characterize these two institutions? Because people lump them together all the time, right? It's like, oh, those are the two best business schools in Europe, or I mean, that's often what people would say. Mm-hmm. And yet I think of them as really different places, even in terms of, you know, the format of their MBA is really different, but even like, I don't know, just their approach. So how would you, like, what did you see from your side of it?
I mean, I think just as a caveat here, I mean, I was so junior at LBS, right? I mean, it was like basically my first full-time role after graduating, you know, first postgraduate role. And at INSEAD, you're right. I mean, I spent, gosh, I want to say like 5 or 6 years there. I kind of almost grew up as a professional at INSEAD. And so by the time I left, I was considerably more senior, certainly than I had been at LBS. And so part of, you know, that is just to say the view I had was very different. It was much more strategic at INSEAD than it would have been at LBS. But they are similar to each other in a lot of ways, particularly, I think, if you are comparing against just like a lump US school, right? So if you're going like US schools versus international schools, I can see why people lump them together. But just like there's a lot of diversity between and a lot of difference between top US programs, there's also a lot of difference between LBS and INSEAD, both in terms of the kind of profile that seeks to go to those schools. You know, I think at INSEAD, and I don't know what the numbers are at LBS, but I think something like 60%, 50 to 60% of the people who apply to INSEAD only apply to INSEAD. And also just in terms of, you know, the experience. So there's some just really obvious differences, particularly if you're comparing Fontainebleau, INSEAD Fontainebleau, because of course they do have the Singapore campus, and London. I mean, in London, you're going to get a city experience, probably much more similar to, say, the experience I had at Columbia.
Right.
Whereas in Fontainebleau, I mean, you know, people refer to it as, oh, you're right outside of Paris, but you do not feel right outside of Paris.
Right.
I mean,
no.
You really are, you know, in the middle of a forest, and that has, it depends, you know, on what you like, but the experience is very much one of, you are at INSEAD, your social life is at INSEAD, it's the INSEAD parties, it's, you know, it, that is what you do. And LBS is much more, you know, everything you have at the city, in the city, and that has advantages and disadvantages, but it really just depends on the kind of person that you are. And then as you've alluded to, the program is very different. I mean, INSEAD is a 10-month program, which is, you know, incredibly fast. And LBS is 2 years, but has that flexible second year, so you can graduate a few months early if you want to. So even just the pace is very different.
Yeah.
So there are definitely a lot of differences, but I think the similarity is they both value international experience and exposure in a way that I don't see in the US programs. I think a lot of, they would, of course, if you had admissions officers, and I'm sure that you have, of American programs, they would probably debate whether this is true. But in my experience, I feel like US schools look at international experience as like, oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And LBS and INSEAD really understand how character building it is to leave everything you know and move to another country and start over, and so value it in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's actually a good segue, though. I'm kind of curious, like, you go from, you know, you're thinking about politics, the European Commission, you kind of pivot and you end up in this role at LBS, which leads you to a role at INSEAD where you stay for quite some time. But how did you make the leap to then saying, well, I want to get an MBA? And also, like, how did you choose Columbia? I mean, you'd had a you know, front row seat for two of the best programs in Europe. You've been living in Europe. Mm. And then I guess you went to New York, right, with INSEAD. But how did you like discover that an MBA was for you? And how did you land on Columbia?
Well, I want to say it was a really difficult choice because I had incredibly fond memories of my time at LBS and had really grown just super connected to the community at INSEAD. And particularly not to go to INSEAD was really hard at that stage because I just, you know, it wasn't just somewhere I worked, but I really felt a part of the community. And I'd been privileged enough actually to do one of their management acceleration courses at INSEAD. And so have, you know, had alumni status and was able to already at that point attend some alumni events, et cetera. So it was a challenging decision. But for me, it was threefold. The first is going way back to when I was in high school. You know me a little bit, Graham, so it probably will not surprise you to learn that I got into a little bit of trouble when I was in high school. I wasn't fond of rules, and at that point, I wasn't super fond of studying. And I had a teacher who was from New York sit me down after class once and say, "You are incredibly bright. You're incredibly intelligent. You're making really bad choices. And I think if you started to make better choices, you could be at Columbia. I think you have that kind of potential." And I think he just used that school because that's what he knew, because he was from New York. And that always kind of stuck with me. That conversation was one of those really pivotal conversations in my life. It was like what I needed to hear at the right time. And I went on a different track after that and started getting really good grades and having different experiences. And so it had always been kind of this back in my mind dream to go to Columbia, basically, from that one conversation. And then I, you know, moved abroad and so did different things, but it had always kind of been there. And when I was making the decision of what school to go to, honestly, you know, I was living in New York at the time. Columbia had always been this dream. I knew about the program a lot because of just being in the ecosphere. I did the Columbia J term, which is over 50% international. That was also really important to me given my international experience. I wanted to be with that kind of, you know, community of people. But the thing that really kind of tipped me over the edge was I was afraid that if I went to INSEAD, my classmates and recruiters would just assume that I hadn't earned my place because I had worked there. And that wouldn't have been true. In fact, I don't even know if I would have gotten in because my quant on my GMAT was not great. And you know, INSEAD obviously really likes a high quant on the GMAT. So it would have been just as hard for me to get in, but I was just afraid of that perception. And so that's essentially why I didn't apply to INSEAD. And you know, and Columbia just was the right program for me at that time. And why business school? Well, after working in business education for, at that point, 6 or 7 years, I started to realize what an MBA could mean to your career and what kind of opportunities it could afford you. And I also realized how I had not had any of that. You know, I loved my degree in international relations, then did a politics-oriented master's degree, but really just didn't have any kind of business fundamentals. And I also hadn't tried anything else in my career. You know, I'd fallen, kind of stumbled, and like I said, half in luck and half in timing into this kind of business education industry. And I wanted to try and do something more commercial. So I really wanted to try doing consulting. And I knew that the best and probably, if we're honest, only way I was going to make that transition was with a top tier MBA. So that was the motivation. And that's exactly what I did after I graduated. I went into consulting.
Okay. So you kind of have alluded to this, but I want to hear a little bit more about your career post MBA, right? So you went off to Columbia and, you know, you talked a little bit about consulting and stuff, but I just want to hear more about, like, how has your career progressed post MBA? And like, did the MBA ultimately shape the path that you've followed? Or do you think that you kind of, you know, because you had kind of an interesting path pre-MBA that's not traditional, right? I mean, like, and actually that reminds me of myself a little bit, because I did not do the kind of, you know, banking or consulting pre-MBA and then into it. And even post-MBA, I've had kind of a strange career, right? So, but how has your career evolved? And yeah, how did the MBA sort of shape that?
Yeah, I mean, I often say I went to business school wanting to make a career change. And what I got from business school was career freedom. Because I did make the change into consulting, which is exactly what I wanted to do. And then I'm trying to get the timing right. Was it a year and a half or so after I started? So a bit earlier than I was expecting to leave consulting, I was headhunted by a founder of a high growth, or what was billed to me at the time as a high growth SME social enterprise here in London. And I was living in New York. I was working with Capgemini in New York, and I'd always wanted to come back to the UK. I thought in my mind, like a lot of people, I considered consulting. I would do it for, you know, 3 or 4 years and then see what opportunities presented after that, and maybe come back to Europe. But kind of got this opportunity and to lead a consulting practice and lead talent for the purpose of this organization was incredible to me. So they, at the time, recruited people from emerging markets. So people mostly from Africa, some Asian markets as well, that were living, working, or had been educated in Europe, the US, to go back to their home countries and work in their home countries. So it was essentially to reverse the brain drain.
Wow.
And that was, you know, an incredibly powerful mission to me. And so the opportunity to get involved and be, you know, incredibly senior in the organization was one I just wanted to take. But it was a big risk, right? To leave consulting after less than 2 years before I had gotten that promotion to PM, which is what you at least usually try to hang out for.
Right.
And part of my ability to take that risk was because I thought, well, I've got the Columbia MBA to fall back on. So, you know, if this doesn't work out, I'm sure I can get get another job in consulting or something else. I did that for a year. I mean, you know, I don't want to be sued for saying anything, but the organization itself wasn't super well managed. So I love the mission. Had a lot of questions around ethically how the company was managed. And so I left that after a year. And again, that freedom to say, I don't really like what I'm seeing here. I don't think this is ethical. I'm concerned that we're not on the right side of not just ethics, but law in some of these instances. So I'm going to leave the organization and I'm going to do some independent consulting, which is what I did just for a bit until I figured out what I wanted to do. Again, I don't think I would have been able to do that without the MBA, or I might have been able to, but I'm not sure that I would have, you know, because I wouldn't have felt that I had the security. And the amount of opportunities that I have gotten since then, because, and at least in part because of having a Columbia MBA, are, you know, really numerous. And I think there's something about having that brand behind you that will open a door. Now, it won't do the sale for you. You know, you still have to perform and you know, make the sale, whether it's, you know, I'm pitching for a consulting project or doing something like that, for sure. But that ability to get your foot in the door is really of value. And the more I've now, I mean, in my full-time life, I'm back in higher education now. I moved back into business education after I had my son about 3 years ago. But even now, I mean, the frameworks that I'm able to have and the kind of strategic thinking that I'm able to bring to the industry, I know is fortified by my MBA. And so I think for me, the confidence and the brand, having the brand behind me, and also then some of the strategic thinking that I've been able to bring to my roles has been a real value.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. Like I find as well that, you know, it's just odd how I just occasionally recall, you know, a lesson from a marketing class or strategy class. I mean, just the stuff sticks with you. And I also feel like it opens doors. And, you know, I've even done some capital raising with ClearAdmit, and, you know, that just so much easier, obviously, when you have the stamp of approval. But also, I think you absolutely speak to a really important point about how you still have to get up there and do the dance, or do, you know, you've got to pitch.
Yes.
And so that's something that's still required. But so I have to also say, like, I feel like, you know, I mean, you're talented and creative. And I just feel like you always have something new brewing. And, you know, it sounds like you're working in, you're back in higher ed, but you also have this podcast that you've launched. And I just want to know, like, how are you juggling all this? Because the podcast is awesome. I've been tuning in, and it seems like you're doing, I mean, they're coming out pretty fast and furious, right? It's like once a week or every other week or something.
Once a week,
So how are you managing all this?
Well, you know, first of all, Graham, please invite me back anytime, because I just feel like this interview has just been nothing but praise of me, which is amazing. But, you know, I think I'm going to get a little bit on my feminist high horse here. I think a lot of women are champion plate spinners. You know, I think we have to multitask and we do multitask pretty well. So I am somebody that likes new projects. I'm a great starter of new things. I'm not necessarily somebody you keep around to manage something after many years and keep it ticking along, but I love to start new things. And, you know, with the podcast, I had been working on a startup just in very, very early stages prior to the pandemic. And we were just at the stage where we were going to go potentially pitch for investment, pitch for seed funding. And then coronavirus happened and everything ground to a halt. And, you know, it just felt like having all this momentum, like I was like running, and then all of a sudden hit a wall, right? And I wanted to continue on with this momentum, but I knew that it wasn't going to happen with the startup that I had been working on for lots of reasons. We had to hit pause on that. And so the startup was around, you know, promoting women in business and essentially in positions of power. And so I just had this idea, what could I do in that space in the context of the lockdown and of the pandemic, so I could feel like I could use this momentum in some positive way? And I honestly, Graham, did not think I would be doing it past 10 or 12 episodes. I thought it would just kind of be a creative project for me, so I could feel like I've been doing something productive with that energy during lockdown, and that would be that. I thought maybe my friends would listen and then it would be over. And it's kind of taken on a life of its own. I don't want to say it's like not a challenge to juggle it, but it's honestly such a joy to do that I don't experience it as a challenge. So of course it's like a lot of late nights, it's a lot of weekend work, but it's completely worth it, because I'm meeting just incredible, incredible women who are sharing stories in a way that I genuinely do not feel are told as much or in as a prominent way as need to be told. And so I'm not sure if that answered your question, because you ask how I juggle it, but.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me in listening to some of the episodes is it has almost, I know that TED Talks are typically done, you know, solo, right? You go up on stage and you give your, you know, they're always nice and short, which I always admired from Richard Saul Wurman, who started the whole TED conference way back when. But I had like a TED feeling listening to some of these conversations, because you managed to get the guests to be vulnerable and to talk about, like, not just the, like, the photo finish, you know, perfect aspects of their rise to, you know, to power or whatever. Yeah. But the, you know, the kind of warts and all, you know, everything that's happened. And I just, there's like tremendous value in that. But
yeah.
I guess one thing that I thought would be useful is if you could tell folks tuning in, like, are there a couple of episodes or guests that you had that you would want our listeners to check out? I mean, and particularly like keeping in mind that, you know, folks listening to this are, you know, aspiring MBAs. There, a lot of them are, have entrepreneurial visions and, you know, but is there anything that jumps out at you in terms of people you've spoken with on your show that, that people should tune into?
Well, so basically the premise of the show is that I interview women in positions of influence and authority. Some of those are in business and some of those are in politics and some of them are in the arts, and anything kind of in between, and ask them, as you said, to kind of tell their whole truth, what they think, but also how they got to where they've got, and also what they're still struggling with. Because I feel like, you know, we've all heard of like the heroine's journey, right? And or the hero's journey. And so generally speaking, when stories about anybody in, you know, who's gotten to a certain level of prominence in their life, it's always going to be told in this really nice buttoned up arc, right? Like I had a desire. I went forth and tried to achieve it. I encountered a problem. And then at the end, everything was fine. And that makes for a lovely story to read, but it doesn't really mirror our experience. And that's why I thought a lot of these stories that I was reading about women in business or in positions of authority, et cetera, were the opposite of inspirational, because I couldn't relate to them. I was like, but I'm still struggling with stuff now. Like, what are you still struggling with now? And so that's kind of the whole premise. So in terms of the episodes that I think are the most inspirational or you might get the most from, it really depends on what you are interested in. But one that comes to mind is an episode I did recently with Dee Charlemagne, and she is the founder of Avec Drinks, and a really new founder. She's also a Columbia MBA alumna, also Harvard alumna pre-Columbia, and she has a pretty incredible story. You know, she was going to school at public school in the Bronx, I think.
Yep.
And was spotted for, you know, just being incredibly intelligent. The headmaster of that school or the principal of that school encouraged her parents to apply for her to go to, you know, very well-respected boarding school in the East Coast. And she went there on scholarship. And she just has this, you know, this really incredible story and has done lots of really unique and interesting things in her life and is now trying to, you know, start a business and is really open about the fact that it is hard to start a business when you're a new entrepreneur and you don't have a lot of money behind you. Like she's always worried about like how you're going to pay your rent. And she said that in every conference she went to when she was at Columbia, that was the question she asked the now successful entrepreneur: how did you pay your rent when you were just starting your business? And those are the kinds of things that we don't talk enough about, right? That, oh, you know, you really might be eating ground beef for a week because you just don't have the money. And I think that was, you know, that was a really, really nice conversation. Another conversation I had that people might enjoy is with the CEO of Elevate Network. Elevate is, I think, the largest community, women's and business community, and that one just went live as well. She's also based in New York. And then I have a number from further afield. So I interviewed a little bit different, the former Princess of Luxembourg, Tessie Anthony Denasu. And I thought her story was incredibly interesting because she, you know, married into royalty, then divorced royalty, and, you know, has now used that platform to do lots of incredible things. When she's a UNAIDS ambassador, she started an organization called Professors Without Borders. But she too was saying, listen, you know, I have to put food on the table. I don't get hardly any money from the divorce. I've got two boys to support, and I have to do that. And what she talked about was the number of people who ask her to do lots of work for free. And I think that is something that a lot of us can relate to. And, you know, you see that in royalty. You say, well, you know, she's got bills to pay just like the rest of us. And so there's just a lot of relatable stories all around, I think.
Yeah, and it's great that you mentioned those because, obviously the idea of like royalty and leaving royalty is a topical thing right now. And I actually saw you, I think you did a special bonus episode where you talked about the whole, the whole British stuff with Meghan and I guess it's Harry, right? I don't follow this as closely as I should.
So I don't follow it either. I don't follow it either, but I was just so frustrated, I guess is the word, or I just thought it was kind of a teachable moment because the stuff I was seeing, and I need to just get off the socials, to be honest, but the stuff I was seeing on the socials was like, I just don't like her. You know, I can't put my finger on it, but I just don't believe her. Right. And that is misogyny right in front of us. And I just thought it was such a teachable moment that, you know, it's misogyny is just still so prevalent in our culture, even amongst women.
Yeah, agreed.
So that was what that was about.
Yeah. And I feel like I've listened to a number of episodes and there've been a lot of really great moments for me. And I'm glad that you pointed out the interview with Dee because she's a Columbia MBA. So I think that'll relate to our audience. But also I found it really interesting to hear her talk about this sort of like duality of her life, like growing up in the Bronx, in public school. And then she gets, you know, I think she went to Exeter. Or Andover. It's one of the, you know, top boarding schools.
Yes, that's right.
And I was really struck by just, you know, the lessons she learned there from like navigating these two really different worlds. And I actually suspect that that's going to pay dividends for her as a founder and just her ability to like navigate. And it just, it was a really interesting conversation that you had with her. So in any event, I definitely encourage people to go and check out some of the episodes and subscribe. It's great. They come out every week or so. And I've enjoyed all the conversations I've listened to. So, I want to hear what you think about business school and the business world that you've been navigating. Like now that you're seeing it through this lens of the podcast you're running, like, you know, like something simple, like gender parity is getting closer for MBA programs. Like, I don't know off the top of my head what percentage of the Columbia, you know, business school class is women, but I think it's 40% or it's getting there.
Yeah.
Most of the very top schools are, you know, they're getting closer and closer to that 50% mark, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the business school kind of environment and the recruiting experience treats women and men equally. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. And I also wondered if you've ever picked up on whether or not it varies from, say, the U.S. environment versus the European environment in terms of studying business and men and women.
Well, yes. So we're getting there in terms of parity, as you say, of women doing MBAs. And that is a good thing. But I think we still have a long way to go towards, as you mentioned, the experience in business school. And leading on from that, 10 years, 15, 20 years out from business school. I mean, you know, the number of women in either CEO positions or close is still pathetic.
Yep.
And every year it's, you know, oh, look at how much it's improved, but like it's still a pathetic number. And in the UK, for example, on the gender pay gap, I mean, we actually went backwards in the last one in a lot of ways. So, you know, women are still being paid less. We're still not getting to the top, you know, so some of the, you know, KPIs we're getting better on, but the actual outcomes, I mean, if we were being measured on this, like if the business was promoting women to power, like we would be out of business, right? Because we just have not done a very good job of that. And, you know, I'm going back quite a ways. Like you mentioned, we met 15 years ago, which made me feel so old, but it's true. And I obviously, you and I graduated. Yeah. Very, very old. I mean, I graduated in 2012, but when I was at Columbia, I think we had two women, I want to say, in elected office in any of the student, like, not in terms of just like not in the Women in Business Club, but in the school wide stuff. I don't think there was a single cluster chair in the first year that was a woman. And I talk to students all the time and pretty much we're the same, right? And if you do have like a class president who's a woman somewhere, it's like, oh my God, look, there's a class president, it's a woman. It's still an event. And this might seem trivial, right? Mm-hmm. Because who, honestly, 10 years later, who cares who was your class president? Nobody. But what it goes to show is that either women, even at the stage when they're going to business school, are opting out of the most senior roles they can have in that environment, or they're not being elected to those most senior roles they can have in that environment, or a combination of both. And for me, that portends what you're going to see 10 or 15 years later when you apply that same, you know, leadership parameters in within business. And so we need to somehow do better. And, you know, everything from making sure that cases are written from, you know, the perspective of women to, I mean, I remember having a leadership class and being told like the way to go into a new environment and establish relationships with that new environment was to make sure that you were up on the latest sports news. And I was like, well, that's great, but nobody's going to establish a relationship with me by knowing the latest sports news. So maybe we can think about it as in a wider, and that's just like a small trivial thing, right? But I think it's a lot of those small trivial things that add up to an experience that is not equitable.
Yeah, and I think, again, I too have been pleased to see some of the numbers moving in the right direction with respect to like the, you know, women in business school, but I could not agree more that we don't yet seem to be seeing much on the back end of it. And I, you know, hadn't thought about even within the MBA experience, like the number of women in elected positions and things. So that's something to keep tabs on. And I'm hoping that some of the rankings bodies and people, you know, keeping tabs on business schools will increasingly look at that stuff because it matters. And I also, you know, on clearadmit.com, we hear a lot about, you know, candidates asking those questions, like, well, what's it like there? And what's the, you know, how diverse is the student body and, you know, how active are women in clubs and like what's, you know, so there are questions about that. And yeah, there's still a long way to go. And I, you know, again, I know you feel like I keep patting you on the back and stuff, but I think, you know, your stuff like your podcast is helping. It's helping, I think, in terms of people seeing the experiences that women, you know, who have risen to prominent positions have had. And so hopefully that helps too, because it sets the kind of role model. There's been plenty of podcasts about successful business leaders who are male. Mm. And so, you know, I think this is like much, much needed. And also just that idea that, as you said, the stories are much more relatable. So that helps.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you know, there was this big, sorry, there was just to drill down this a little bit longer, but there was a big story about the new Dean of Wharton, of course, being a woman.
Yes.
And for me, that is incredible progress, right? Incredible progress. But also, we won't know we've really made the progress we need until that's not a news story.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, frankly, like, I think there was like a little part of me that felt that way about the vice president of the U.S., you know, this like focus on, you know, I mean, I think it's great. You know, I was like, okay, but you know, that like, I want to know more about like her policies and like what she wants to do. Like, I don't want this to just be about the fact that she's a woman. And in her case, obviously woman of color, right. Like there's a lot of elements of her background that are super interesting and that are firsts. But as you say, like, I'd love it for it to be not like a non-story that, you know, let's just talk about like, well, what does she want to do? You know, so, but yeah, sadly, we're not.
And the thing is, it can't be a non-story yet because because we don't have the representation that we need, but hopefully we'll get there and then it will be a non-story.
Yeah, totally. So, I have to ask, because you worked in admissions, you've even done some admissions consulting, and you know, you went to a great MBA program and got in. So, like, what advice would you have for our audience about like getting into business school or even, you know, thriving as an entrepreneur? Because I personally feel like there are so many people who they have these entrepreneurial ideas and then they get to business school and they take the safe path, they go and, you know, they just sort of follow everyone else into tech or whatever they're doing now, whatever's popular. But do you have advice for like just going it on your own, setting something up? And so it's kind of a two-part question. Let's start with the business school stuff. Any advice on like how to get into a top MBA?
My advice for getting into a top MBA is tell a good story. So I feel like people focus so much on things like their grades and their GMAT and, you know, all of that sort of auxiliary stuff. And don't get me wrong, you need that stuff. But the way I like to see it, the way I like to view it is, for example, like your GMAT, it's your ticket to play the game.
Right.
And then your story, the application that you craft, that's actually how you're playing the game. right? You can't get to the field unless you have the GMAT and all the requirements. That's just the precursor. But I think what a lot of people maybe don't understand is that the kind of people who work in admissions at a business school usually are not from business.
Right.
You know, usually they have like degrees in like English literature or, you know, something like that. And,
right.
you know, they need you to tell a good story. They need you to like have a good narrative and have good examples and tell them in a really compelling way. And so if you are not a naturally gifted writer, that is totally fine. A lot of people aren't, but make sure that you're like, you've got a friend or somebody else who is a gifted writer who's helping you craft that story that is going to be compelling and set you apart from everybody else. And I think that's what I see, at least from a lot of people. I see, but like, I've done everything right. My CV reads so well, or my resume reads so well, and I've got a high GMAT. And then they're confused as to why they didn't get into, you know, a program because they didn't tell a good story. And one really actionable piece of advice that I can give everybody right now that is free is watch Simon Sinek's Start With Why TED Talk. You mentioned TED before. It's old. The TED Talk is really old now. The AV on it is really, really bad. But nevertheless, the concept of communicating your why first and your what last is really powerful in just about any scenario, but I find it's, you know, very helpful in when you're doing your applications. And I think a lot of people forget that and they just communicate the what. Well, I've done this and I've done this and I've done this, instead of communicating the overall impact they're really trying to drive in their lives.
Yeah, great advice. Like, I think people are, it's almost like they become very transactional. They're like, well, I have a 760, I have a 3.8, I went to an Ivy League school, they're going to take me. I don't really need to do anything else. This is just a transaction.
Yeah.
And I think, I used to talk about this ad nauseum, about this idea that, you know, admissions, you know your audience, like admissions readers are not business people.
Yes.
And I feel like people forget that all the time. And that even comes down to like not using acronyms or business speak that's specific to your industry, that's going to lose even an intelligent reader who just doesn't, you know a lot about like CapEx or, you know, different stuff, right? So that's great advice. So what about advice for thriving as an entrepreneur?
Oh gosh, let me think about good advice to thrive as an entrepreneur. I mean, to be honest, Graham, you are probably even more qualified to answer this question than I am. But I have a really high appetite for risk. And I think that is one of the things that has helped me. But also, I mean, I'm doing entrepreneurial things, but I'm also like not trying to build multi-billion dollar businesses that I'm going to sell, right? So that might be a different equation if I was doing it. I mean, for me as an entrepreneur, with the stuff that I look to get involved in, this is pretty basic stuff, but I'm just always looking for asymmetric risk. So I'm definitely willing to like branch out and do something and try something new, because I know that if it doesn't work out, I've got something else to fall back on. It kind of goes back to what we were saying before, and that's helped quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But I think knowing yourself, because for some people, that's not going to be the best way forward. You know, some people are going to perform better when they have a much more certain, I mean, there is no certainty in life, but a more certain cash flow situation, for example, and, you know, might just prefer the certainty of having a salary and a bonus that they can more or less rely on. And that is also okay. I mean, one of the things I've seen, I think you've mentioned, you know, people come in with ideas of being an entrepreneur and then go into tech or whatever, sexy. But I also think there's something else happening, which is like, entrepreneurship is the sexy thing.
Yeah.
And I also want to tell people, look, you know, if you want to be a banker, if you love finance and you want to be a banker, or you want to go into tech, you want to be a project manager, you want to pay off your loans before you think about doing anything else, that is fine too. That's also totally okay.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I felt like I met a lot of people in business school who, like you said, like starting, you know, doing a startup was really sexy when I was in business school, and people were, you know, everyone wanted to do it. And a lot of these people, I was like, you know, you'd actually probably just be better at doing like consulting with McKinsey.
Yeah.
Or why don't you, you know, take that that skill you have in, you know, finance and go work at Goldman for a while. Like I just, you know, sometimes not everyone's going to be like sort of well suited to being an entrepreneur. I think, yeah, it's a strange, I don't know. Sometimes I wonder why I do it, but I, you know, and maybe you feel the same, but it's always an adventure. I really appreciate
what I would say as well. Sorry, just on this can I just also say one other thing on the entrepreneurship thing? Sorry, you probably turned about the conversation, which is you can always dip your toe in.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's lots of ways to be entrepreneurial without leaving everything you know and like throwing everything at a new business, right? You can get involved in somebody else's business, you can invest in it, you can start something small on the side. You know, there's lots of different ways to get involved without throwing the kitchen sink. And so, you know, also potentially try that, I would say.
Yeah, that's a great point. You don't have to go all in. I did want to, if you have time, I wanted to ask you, I have these kind of lightning round questions that I like to ask, actually reminds me of, I know on your podcast, you always ask a set of questions at the end as well. I usually reserve these for when I do like admissions officer discussions, but I think they're fun. And it's just a great way to kind of get to know someone. So if you have a few minutes, I wanted to ask you some like fast questions.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So, okay. What's your go-to beverage?
Champagne.
I knew you were going to say that. A superpower that you wish you had.
Oh gosh, a superpower. I mean, obviously flight, but are you talking about like one that really exists in life?
No, it could be anything, whatever you want.
I mean, obviously I wish I could fly. Like flying is the best superpower. Don't you wish you could fly? It's the very best one.
Yes, that's probably fair. all right. What about like a pet peeve?
My pet peeve is when people are rude to anybody in service, like a waiter or, you know, anybody in service. It is like an incredible pet peeve of mine.
Oh my God. I'm right there with you. And in fact, that's something that I, you know, think is really applicable to MBA applicants in the sense that I always tell people like when you show up for an interview and this is pre-pandemic, of course, but when you show up in an office and there's like an administrative person at the front desk, you know, treat that person absolutely with respect. I mean, I can't even believe people need to be told that, but I can tell you like firsthand, and when I worked in admissions at Wharton, if someone was a jerk out in the front room to the, you know, person at the front, like that made its way to the admissions committee. Like we would hear about that. So be nice to everyone. What have you found has been useful with respect to coping with the pandemic? Any tips or something that like has gotten you through?
A few things. The first and most important thing is grace. Grace for yourself and grace for others. I mean, a really practical example is I used to believe very strongly in limiting TV time for my son. My son's 2.5. And I'll tell you that we have embraced Disney Plus in the last year. and I'm feeling absolutely no guilt about it because, you know, we've all got to get through what we can get through. Mm-hmm. Second is the Oculus. Do you have an Oculus?
No.
The Oculus Quest 2. Oh my God. Okay, this thing is going to change your life, Graham. I can't even believe I'm saying this, but my husband was, for your listeners who might not know, an Oculus Quest 2 is the VR headset that Facebook sells. And I'm sure there are other VR headsets around there. But anyway, my husband was like nagging me for like a year to get this Oculus. And I was like, we're not going to have a VR headset. Like, what are you talking about? We're not going to have this VR headset in our house. We're like, I'll lose you to video games. We're never going to use it. Finally, I acquiesced and got it for him as a gift for Valentine's Day. And it's essentially mine now. And my number one way to get through lockdown is to play Beat Saber on the Oculus. It is so much fun. And it's like exercise you can do. Guys, I'm not a runner. I don't like to go out and run. But, you know, so I love a spin class. I do have a Peloton, but it's just not really the same. So I've kind of just missed, you know, being more active in a way that isn't just like walking or running outside. And that has really helped me get through the last couple of months. We've been, just for context, I'm in the UK, so we've been in lockdown again for the last 6 weeks.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That sounds like, okay, that's good. So we don't have any virtual reality headsets lying around here, but that's good to know. that's interesting. I definitely miss that aspect. I mean, we have not been as locked down in France here, but although they just announced that they're relocking us down a bit, but that. It's just been hard to not be able to go out and about and stuff. So this is going to be a little bit of a curveball, but I wondered if you had a music recommendation for our listeners.
Oh, I feel a bit intimidated to talk about music with you. But let me think about a music. In another life, I used to be, or used to go to more, you know, nighttime outings, raves mm-hmm. and such. And so I am a fan of deep house. Mm-hmm. And there is a particular DJ that I like that puts on nights in London quite a bit, or used to pre-pandemic.
Right.
And his name is Aidan Daughtry. And if you look him up on SoundCloud or what have you, I think his stuff is really great.
Cool. Okay. That's a good rec. Hopefully our listeners are noting that. So that's all I had in terms of lightning stuff, but I really appreciate you making time to chat. And, you know, I just encourage everyone to check out the Power Done Differently podcast, and, you know, make notes here, because I think there was a lot of really good advice in terms of how to present yourself to business school and just, you know, lots of little tidbits about Columbia and even LBS and INSEAD. So really appreciate you sharing all this stuff, Cassandra. And yeah, I just can't thank you enough for making time.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. This has been so much fun. And, you know, if anybody has questions about Columbia, I'm always super happy to help anybody. So, you know, people can feel free to look me up on LinkedIn and send me a message. If you're serious about applying and you have a direct question, I'm happy to help.
Terrific. Appreciate you being willing to do that. So everyone, stay tuned for more special episodes of the podcast. I've got a lot of other guests coming, and we'll see you all really soon.
Thanks, Graham.